it's time to meet up and catch up at the Weekend Water Cooler. Now, here's your host, Gene Bolduc.
Welcome, everyone, to the Weekend Water Cooler. Joining us today, the second vice chair of the North Carolina Democratic Party. Oh, I'm so cheap, I don't have a drum roll to offer, but I will just ask my listeners to imagine a drum roll and then a big crash of the cymbals, and I'll say, Mr. Matt Hughes, welcome
Thank
to the
you.
Water Cooler.
I'm so happy to be here.
Have you. Great, great. So today, my objective with Matt is to demonstrate to him that he's really a conservative and just doesn't realize it. And now everybody listening to the show just fainted. That's what happened.
I mean, you know, there are people out there listening who probably say Matt is a Democrat. He is therefore conservative. You know, we do have folks in our community that.
That's true. You know, in the South, you can't really make assumptions about conservative versus liberal. That's true.
Yeah.
We're an interesting mix.
Orange County is a very progressive place. So
yeah, it is.
There are people.
It
who
is,
probably
but you
think,
know, a lot of people think that Democrat equals liberal. But let me tell you that I just don't think it's a given. I think that there are areas of policy where and we've talked, I'm just going to give it away that we've talked about this a little bit before we started the show. There are areas of public policy where I believe the Republicans, and therefore presumably mostly conservatives, have missed opportunities in representing themselves well to the general electorate on issues that are important issues of public policy that we associate with Democrats, but really have, there are legitimate conservative arguments for these issues. I wrote an essay about this some years ago, and I brought it with me, and I'm just gonna go through and tick off some of these and have you react to them. And the first one.
And by the way, even though we've spoken about this, I do not know what the arguments are. So this is not rehearsed. This is a genuine conversation.
That's right. I just gave you the general idea. So here are the what I call these are my top 10 issues where conservative arguments for a modern GOP. If anybody's listening in the GOP, you might want to hit record because, I mean, this is really the deal. So the first one, because I consider it to be first among all of these, is marriage equality. You're in favor of that, right?
Of course.
Of course. And I just want to, just for the record, want to mention to everyone that this was published in March of 2013 before the Windsor decision came down, ending DOMA and so forth, and making marriage equality the law of the land. And my argument for the conservatives was that they should be practical, that the court was going to reverse the Defense of Marriage Act and declare Prop 8 from California unconstitutional, and that the thing for the conservatives to do at the time was to jump in, declare victory, and say, you know, it's the law of the land and conservatives respect the law. They supposedly, I mean, especially when it goes in their favor, but they supposedly respect the Supreme Court. So isn't that the reason why this issue should be dropped and be dead as a doornail with conservatives now, because they should say, well, it's the law, so it's been litigated, that's it, the end.
Well, I think so. You know, on the progressive side, we look at it as a civil rights issue.
Right.
I think on the conservative end of things, which we do associate more with religious freedom and whatnot, I think this is also a religious freedom issue, that there are churches who may have wanted to promote marriage of all folks, whether you're gay or straight,
right,
within their churches, and they were prohibited from doing so.
That's a good point. That's kind of an inversion of how that's been used to,
right,
to try to block it.
So rather than looking at it from the standpoint of churches being forced to perform these same-sex marriages, I mean, you have it in the other way of churches who were denied the ability to choose for themselves if that was something they wanted to do, and have it carry legal weight, that have,
right,
those ceremonies carry legal weight. I think also, while we do think about it in terms of a rights issue and what people are denied if they're not able to get married, I think you can also look at it from the standpoint is marriage is a conservative institution inherently, and I would think that conservatives would want to see more people get married, that you are committing to one person hopefully for the rest of your life, and that you're going to develop a family and have that normal family structure.
Right, right. And you know, I've written a couple of columns about this in the newspaper, and I've said this many, many times, that that marriage is a contract of monogamy. It is not a contract of heterosexuality. And if it were the other way, then people who get married and elect not to have children, people like Pat Buchanan, would never be allowed to get married. People who have raised their families, are in their 60s, are done with childbearing, have their spouses die, and then fall in love again and want to remarry in order to create, you know, a family, mm-hmm. a family of, you know, people who are widowed and then remarry, they wouldn't be allowed to get married either because of some idea that if you're not procreating, then you shouldn't get married. You
right.
know, that's
and
just
and
silly.
I think also people should also, you know, one of the big things we would hear from conservatives at the time was changing the definition of marriage. But that definition has been changing and evolving.
All
over,
it does is change.
Over right. centuries, including in this country.
Right.
I tried to look this up a few months ago. There was a legislator, I believe, somewhere in Louisiana or Mississippi in the late 1800s or early 1900s, who literally pushed a bill through the legislature to change the definition. So he would benefit because he was trying to divorce his wife or something like that. So,
well, there you go. You know, when it's about divorcing your wife, then we should all consider that. But when it's about expanding this to allow every American citizen who wants to commit themselves to one other person. I just, wow. And, you know, now that this has happened, since I initially published this, let's consider just for a moment, because a moment is all it will take, the many and sundry examples of how our society has totally crumbled and blown apart at the seams because men have married men and women have married women. I can't think of a single example, actually. No.
No, the world has continued to turn.
And by the way, also true is that men have divorced men and women have divorced women. And, you know, just like has been going on with heterosexual couples all along, people who don't want to be married anymore shouldn't be married anymore.
Well, a lot of my
friends... There's that freedom that people don't talk about
a lot
much.
Of my more conservative friends, you know, in backyard barbecues before gay marriage was legal, said, I believe gay people should be able to be just as miserable as the rest of us.
There you
so
go.
There
exactly
you go.
Right. Aren't these people that you really want to...
Of course, they were joking, you know, kind of looking off to the side, like, I hope my spouse didn't hear that.
Yeah, but you know, they're looking at the total picture, which is that, you know, when you get together with someone and you make a commitment and then it doesn't work out.
There's an incentive to work it out.
You should be fighting over who gets the living room furniture just like everybody
else.
Well,
but then there's also that incentive to work it out.
Yeah, that's right.
When you're just together, you're dating, but you're not married, you know, you can easily pack up and say, hey, we're done.
We're done.
But
right.
when you're married and you've made that commitment
right.
and whatnot, then there is that incentive to work it out.
Yes, and that's true. And I'm old and I got married a long time ago. And before I got married, I lived with my husband, much to my mother's chagrin, I have to say. Bless
or
her
dismay.
Heart. Rest her soul. This is not what killed her, but she acted like it would at the time. And... the thing was, we decided to get married, and then we decided to live together because we thought that I was very young, very, very young. The word teenager should come to your mind. And my parent, now that I have children who are well past that age, I can tell you, I would have felt the same way. but you know, they were like, oh, you know, maybe don't get married. Maybe just live together because then you can grow out of this and you'll be fine. Without all of the implications, but that's what happened, and I was very lucky. I found the right person, and some would argue that he was lucky also. But I'm not going to make that argument. That's for him to do. But that's the odds are against you, you know, in being really young and finding the right person. And at that time, this is in the late 70s, there was plenty of stigma available for living together without benefit of being married. I was not known to my husband's landlord, for example. I was just somebody who visited a lot. And, I mean, a lot of those things, including at that time, my parents were getting a divorce and my mother couldn't get a credit card.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of things have changed, giving a lot of freedom to people, causing less social pressure for them to get married just for the sake of living in the same household. I think all of that is good, really, overall.
Well, and I know we'll talk about this hopefully later in the conversation, but, you know, that was one of the things that confounded Hillary Clinton when she went down to Arkansas, you know, when she met Bill Clinton and you know, those types of things of where's your husband to get this loan or or how, you know, as a businesswoman at the time, how, you know, she was treated differently. So.
And what a, I can't say that word on the radio, what a cluster, you know what it was that she wanted to keep her maiden name. What an unthinkable embarrassment. Oh, my goodness. And yet today, this
as a juxtaposition, you know, she wasn't able to keep her maiden name and have her husband be politically successful, yet her running mate, Tim Kaine, his wife, kept her maiden name. And by then, it was no big deal.
Yeah, by then, it was absolutely, completely unremarkable. I mean, and I almost wish she had gone back to Rodham when she started running for president or when she ran for the Senate just to say, okay, I'm done with complying with that made-up rule. Mm-hmm. That would have been a good thing. Well, we're going to talk a lot more about Hillary. We have a lot to talk about today. So we're going to take a quick break. We're talking with Matt Hughes here on the Weekend Water Cooler. You're listening to 97.9 The Hill. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back talking with Matt Hughes about the 10, now 9 ways that I can prove that he's really a conservative. And the next one I have for you is about climate change and environmental protection and anybody who's a fan of Theodore Roosevelt, a famous Republican, knows that they're preserving the environment and preserving, therefore, America's natural resources is, Richard Nixon, I'm looking at you, a conservative position. I mean, I really, for the life of me, do not understand why when the former chairman of ExxonMobil, now our Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, has a position that says, yeah, of course there's climate change and we have to deal with this in order to continue doing our business as an energy company. And now he doesn't say anything about it now to contradict his boss, a raving lunatic. But, you know, of course that's the smart, efficient use of resources is a conservative thing to do.
And we don't have infinite resources, you know.
Americans should be able to admit that. Yeah.
Some of the resources we have, some people would say, yeah, well, fossil fuels can regenerate. Yeah, if you have a couple million years to sit around and wait for it.
That's right. I'm just impatient, I admit.
But I think it's a conservative idea, and I think a lot of people who would be progressive politically would probably subscribe to that conservative idea that you have to preserve what we've got because, you know, like I learned in seventh grade, the water we've got is the water we've got.
It's the water we've got. That's right. This is a legitimate platform for a conservative candidate to say, you know, in an energy crisis, Richard Nixon asked me in 1973 to conserve energy. That's a perfectly appropriate position. It's also appropriate from a conservative perspective to say decisions that we make today about the environment affect people who are not yet born in this century, who will be alive in 2100, people who are born in this century and will be alive in 2100 and will be Americans and who want clean air and clean water and natural resources to be able to sustain themselves. And
I think also if you look at it, a lot of progressives don't talk about it in this way, but I think it would resonate with more conservative people and voters is that climate change ultimately is a national security issue.
Oh, it absolutely is. That's an excellent point.
A lot of people are right. You know, conservatives said, you know, climate change didn't cause these hurricanes. You're right. It didn't. But they're bigger. They're stronger. They come more frequently. They cause a whole lot more damage. And can you just imagine, you know, a situation like Harvey or an Irma or, you know, hopefully not a Jose as it's spinning out there in the
or Sandy, Superstorm Sandy.
In the Atlantic. But, you know, a country like North Korea using that as an opportunity that the United States is distracted and let's do something dangerous or provocative and then having to look at two different things or also just, you know, the destabilization we see in several parts of the world with hunger or starvation or disease or drought because of climate change.
That's right. And, you know, the military is way ahead of the the political apparatus, I think, in Washington, it's fair to say, in recognizing exactly that point and how they're managing their resources and having to move some military bases because of the water levels in some of these ports. It's just going to be too problematic. It's great to see their involvement in the relief efforts in Florida, especially. I didn't know this before. We're recording today on September 13th for air on the 23rd, but I've just learned in the last few days that in Florida, all of in the panhandle of Florida, refined gasoline, is brought in by land. It's brought in by trucks and trains and so forth. In the rest of the state of Florida, the entire state of Florida, it's all brought in through shipping lanes. And of course, now with ports so disrupted by the storm, that's going to be a great big serious problem between now and the time this program airs. And I'm quite confident, unfortunately, that it won't be all straightened out by then. And that's 10 days' time. Mm-hmm. That's an enormous burden on that state. And they're going to have to figure out, you know, these things. It's going to be fascinating to watch how Florida and Texas and other states affected, but those obviously are the worst, are going to rebuild their infrastructure. Which brings me to one of my other topics, which is infrastructure and infrastructure investment. And this used to be something that was completely nonpartisan.
Absolutely.
And for some reason,
we have the Eisenhower highway system. Right.
Now, because of the expenditure of it, just the money, Republicans, because Democrats have wanted to do this in part as a way to stimulate the economy after the Great Recession, to be sure. But the Democrats have also wanted to do this because the cost of the money for doing infrastructure has been little or nothing. The interest rates that the government would pay, and the government does have to pay interest when it borrows money, would be nothing, would be zero interest. This is the time to borrow money, especially if you're the government. If you're the U.S. government, you have the full faith and credit of the U.S. government.
And a lot of our debt, you know, we pay a lot every month in interest. And substantial interest. So if the federal government could save, you know, that was the big, that was the big reason why we had the Connect NC bond last year is because the governor and the governor at the time and the legislature looked and said, this is a great time to borrow money because we're not going to be able to get it less. And that's also why Orange County did same thing.
Exactly right. And when you do this and you increase economic capacity for communities all across the country, this is obviously an investment that pays off all over the country for everyone about equally. The jobs can't be exported, and there's just nothing but good news in infrastructure investment, and we ought to be doing that. My next issue, which I'm going to have to go through these quickly, is reproductive rights, the right to choose. Conservatives ought to be pro-choice.
Well, and not just the right to choose, but as Roe v. Wade established, a right to privacy from the government.
Exactly.
And the right to not have the government tell you what to do with your body.
Right. You can do this and you can't do that. How in the world that doesn't obviously fall under life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The right to life, that whole argument, is for persons, and you're not a person until you're born, the interpretation that I've heard from many, many, many very, very smart lawyers, including some of the lawyers who argued Roe, is that, you know, that's just what the Constitution says. A natural born person is a born person.
Well, and I think
not
also,
an unborn person.
And also, you know, and I have friends who do not like the way this is phrased, but I do believe that when a woman decides to terminate a pregnancy, that is not an easy decision for most people to make, and they do consult with their family and their doctor, and you know if they're religious, then you know they're the religious figures in their life or their God, and to me the whole dialogue on that is so so trivial right. in terms of how there are those who want to restrict the right to choose.
Yeah, it would tend to suggest that women would be women in that situation would be frivolous about such a decision, and there's absolutely not
well, and also
a shred
these same
of
politicians
to suggest
who want to restrict the right to choose and subscribe themselves to a pro-life viewpoint also do not fund education adequately or health care adequately either,
right.
which I think would be in line with pro
I think it
so-called
would be
pro-life
it would be, wouldn't it?
Worldviews.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Apply logic to the situation. You're always dragging logic into these things. We're going to continue with more logic with Matt Hughes. We're going to be right back. You're listening to The Weekend Water Cooler on 97.9 The Hill. And we're back talking more with some more with Matt Hughes, the second vice chair of the North Carolina Democratic Party. What does this mean in terms of your responsibilities? Is you have to be standing by watching for something to happen to the first vice chair?
So, not exactly. So, within the state party, we do have three vice chairs, and I think they number them first, second, and third because, I don't know, we didn't decide to name them something different, like vice president for voter education or whatnot, or vice chair, rather.
Yeah.
But a lot of my responsibilities involve going all over the state. I've been to almost half of the 100 counties in North Carolina.
Oh, great.
Speaking at events or meeting with possible candidates or, helping folks fundraise and all these other things, sitting on strategy sessions. And, you know, the takeaway is, and I think more people are understanding in the aftermath of this last election, that we can't just focus in the places like Orange and Durham and Wake and Mecklenburg and
right.
our 16 or so big counties, that we
right.
have to go out there. And so
right.
when people say, Matt, why do you go to this deeply red county like Brunswick County? And I would say, if you look at the math, Brunswick County was 2-1 for Pat McCrory. Brunswick County also gave 25,000 votes to Roy Cooper for governor. Roy Cooper won by 13,000. So even these red counties out
mm-hmm.
there,
out
so
there.
Many of them
mm-hmm.
really factor into that statewide calculus in a blowout election like what we had in 2012 when McCrory was elected. Yeah, that probably wouldn't have made a difference. But in these tight elections, and we should be planning for the tight elections.
Boy, next year, wow. Yeah.
But also, we don't know how some of these legislative districts will perform until we put up a candidate, right?
That's
so
right.
So we got to recruit candidates to run in as many of these 170 legislative districts. So that's what I'm focused on at the state party.
Gosh, that's fascinating. You know, if you get in there, I mean, I bet when you talk to people, even conservatives that you talk to, will probably say, well, you know, I voted for this guy because I didn't hear anybody else talking.
Well, and then also the Democrats in those areas, even if we know it's going to be a solid Republican district, they need a choice. And we need a candidate going out there articulating what the Democratic vision is and stand up for the Democrat record and the record of our governor. So it plays multiple roles.
Yeah, and that lays the good groundwork for getting him reelected too, right?
Well, and hopefully making Mr. Trump a one-term president.
Yeah, won't that be a great thing? Oh, I'm a fan of that work. I'm a fan of that work. So here's another issue where we associate it as a progressive issue, but I can make a conservative argument, and I bet you would share that argument, which is public education reform. This is where we're talking about. It's very, very difficult to innovate in public schools
mm-hmm.
because you have so many baseline requirements, and you don't want necessarily anybody to experiment on your kid.
Right.
Right. So you got to meet these standards. But we need innovation in schools and in education. You have children with a variety of needs. Some of them, the public schools generally, I think are built for the 80% that are in the middle, not the 10% that are that go really fast or the 10% that go a lot slower. And the schools, the curriculum, the whole system kind of moves along at a blob, at a painful rate sometimes. And so I think that the issues of innovation and in supporting charter schools, which are public schools but have far less regulation, a lot more freedom to experiment, but are still accountable I think conservatives should be in favor of this. I know that they're in favor of vouchers. I don't go quite that far.
And what you say, though, is getting charter schools back to where they were originally, which was they were supposed to be these laboratories of innovation.
Exactly.
That they were supposed to be these institutions where some of the regulations were relaxed and move forward and be able to take what is learned in those environments and translate them back to the traditional public schools.
Right. To the extent possible. Sometimes you can't.
Sometimes you have things that are very unique, but we do know that there are charter schools like in the inner city of New York City that is doing
very well on how to educate
minority students, right?
Right.
So there's all, whether it's students with disabilities or minority students or just how to teach things better to students. But I think that the way that the Republicans in the General Assembly are pushing charter schools is a perversion of the original intent of
charter schools. It is, because I think that they're doing it so that they can create for-profit entities, which is not what charter schools were intended for at all. I don't think the profit motive helps everything. So that's my, you know, that's where I am on that. So let me run through a couple more. Gun control. Gun control seems pretty easy. It seems to me that progressives generally want gun control. I don't think I can name any progressive politician except maybe Bernie Sanders, but that's even a stretch for me to say that, who is not in favor of background checks and reasonable control of who can own firearms and how many of them they can have, mm-hmm. how much ammunition they can possess.
One of the most NRA-friendly Democrats in the U.S. Senate is Joe Manchin, and he was part of a gun control measure right after Sandy Hook. He was taking the lead on that. So,
you know, how that didn't pass is just a breathtaking defeat in my mind. It's an embarrassing defeat for the Congress. Not for either party particularly, but for the Congress, because they had absolutely clear evidence that the overwhelming majority, 80% and more of the country, wanted certain things, instant background checks and waiting periods, and none of this was about denying anybody's right to own a firearm. It was about having reasonable controls.
Well, and it's not just the majority of the general population. The vast majority of gun owners also believe in these things.
So that was all about the NRA flexing its ability to influence. And it was not about representing the people and what the people wanted and what's best for public policy, which sometimes even if the people want something, oh, they want it so bad they can almost taste it. You don't necessarily give it to them just because that's what they want.
Right.
You have to do sound research and stand on what's the right public policy. And I just thought institutionally the Congress had this stunning failure to get anything done.
Well, and we saw, you know, in the administration of George Bush, the Brady Bill expiring, which was signed, if I'm not mistaken, by his father into law and was pushed by Ronald Reagan.
Yes, yes.
And
you know, for a good reason, and was endorsed by Nancy Reagan. I think she attended the signing ceremony. So, so I'm going to run out of time on my 29 million issues, but the last one I'll mention is equal pay for equal work. It seems like still the conservatives can come up with reasons why they're not sure if they're totally, you know, okay with these bills for that. I'm like, how do you not see that a meritocracy is the way to go when it comes to, you know, may the best person win in the contest for getting a job, for keeping a job, for being rewarded for a job, and that their gender has absolutely nothing to do with.
Well, Gene, let's flip the tables. Let's say you and I are in the same job. You make more than me. I find out that you make more than me. Our qualifications are almost similar. What's my incentive to work just as hard as you?
Right.
If you're going to make more no matter what I do.
Right. That makes no sense at all. And if I say, well, but I, you know, and I heard this all the time, you know, in my 20s. Oh, but he has, you know, he's married and he has kids to take care of. And I'm like, I'm married. I have kids to take care of. Yeah, but you have a husband. And so Yeah, and, you know, I mean, this is an argument so ridiculous it was played out on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, a situation comedy. Right. So I do not understand why, when this has been the law for so long, and when conservatives love to describe themselves as once again as the law and order party, why they suddenly get amnesia on this type of thing that's really been the law for quite a long time. So they should, you know, you agree with me about this, and I agree with this argument. That's a conservative argument. They should also be in favor of minimum wage, by the way. And, you know, that's about stability in the workforce and what it should pay to have a job. You shouldn't be living in poverty if you work 40 hours a week at the end. And, you know, see, this is this is radio, and you can't see he's nodding.
Yeah, I'm just nodding my head. You're absolutely right. There should be it should not be possible for someone to be working poor in this country.
That's just silly. It's just silly. So. So I leave the best for last, and that's healthcare. And when we come back, we're gonna cover that, wrap it all up, and put a bow on it. It's gonna be really easy and fast. You know, who knew healthcare could be complicated? We're gonna talk some more about that with Matt Hughes right here on the Weekend Water Cooler. You're listening to 97.9 The Hill. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back with our closing moments with Matt Hughes, and I've left the best for last, which is the easiest one according to some people with orange face and crazy hair, which is healthcare. And really, let's take the conservative position about healthcare. And by the way, watching these guys talk about this is just painful at this point.
You would think after you'd think after 8 years they could get it right, but.
How could they not be in a back room plotting about this?
But the problem is with it, Gene, is the Affordable Care Act is the conservative health care plan.
A lot of people don't know this, Matt.
I don't think there's a lot of Democrats who know that, or a lot of progressives.
They kind of forgot.
But yeah, it is. I mean,
it came from the Heritage Foundation.
I was just about to say the Heritage Foundation. Yeah. So we kind of took their playbook from them, thinking it was more likely to pass.
Yes.
And
Romney, of course, took that and put it into place in Massachusetts. It worked very well.
And it's kind of hard to.
It became known as Romney Care. And then as soon as Barack Obama wanted to make it the law, Romney said, "What? Romney Care? I never heard of it."
He had Romneysia.
He had Romneysia. That's exactly right. That's actually
which is covered.
It is
a pre-existing condition.
It's a pre-existing condition. Well, so my argument is that single payer healthcare, which is basically a national health insurance program where I don't have an insurance card. I'm just covered. I just go and I get my healthcare wherever I get it, any public hospital. Let's set that as a criteria. That there may be private hospitals that have over and above services, that specialty services that I might need a supplemental coverage for. But that basic health care, the equivalent of Medicare, and my husband's on Medicare. I'm very familiar with it. My dad is too. The basics that are provided in Medicare would be provided for every citizen, that it would be Medicare for all, cradle to grave. Everybody's covered. And this would mean taxes would go up. The math is actually not that complicated. On an average of probably about $2,000 per taxpayer, taxes would go up. $2,000 to $3,000 per taxpayer, taxes would go up. Now, paying what I pay for my, I'm grateful to have it, for my Affordable Care Act policy that I have through the exchanges, this would save me money. So having my taxes go up that much doesn't bother me. I think we'd have to transition into it. But overall, this is the cheapest way to provide the best health care.
And we would also have to, you know, find a way to mitigate some other things. You know, while you would benefit significantly because you would, on the whole, even though your taxes would go up, your spending on health insurance would go down.
Right.
You know, someone like me who is very lucky.
Young and healthy.
Well, young and healthy, but also I happen to receive a a health insurance plan through my employer where
see,
I
that
pay
would go away.
That I would pay, but my what I pay every month is less than $50 for my health insurance. So for me, for someone like me, it would be a huge increase in taxes when I'm paying virtually nothing compared
and
to
see
what.
There's the rub. Right.
And so those are the types of things that right. you would have to. We would have to. Tackle right. those challenges or find a way where someone can say, you know what, I want to buy into the public system because I would come out better, I could go to the doctor and whatnot.
Right.
And then you have these other, I mean, I immediately think to our state employees that pay
right.
very little in terms of, you know, premiums every month.
That's true, but it isn't because their health insurance is cheap. It's because their employer is paying for it.
Oh, absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
So the employer pays. Now that in my new magical world, the employer is not paying. This is disconnected from employment completely. It's now
no,
just
absolutely.
Part of the national.
And so I think for some people, though, that's right. going to be a rub. That's going right. to be a sticking point because ultimately – we're people and we're ultimately selfish. And while I may want Gene to have great health insurance, mm-hmm. I'm also thinking about how it impacts me. And
sure.
I think those are the types of things that's one of the reasons why healthcare is always such a volatile issue.
But Matt, I have great news for you because in my magical world with my magical wand, I forgot to mention this, I should have. When you're now covered and this is decoupled from your employment, now your employer is giving you a $2,500 raise because they're paying you instead of paying for your health insurance. How do you feel about that?
Well, of course, I'd feel a lot better about that.
You feel better. You feel a little better.
I mean, I'm supportive of the idea of single payer, but these are the types of things that...
Right. And for the state...
We'd have
it's important to realize, too, for the state...
Now, for the state, though, I would be very... as long as the current crew is in charge, those state employees are probably not going to see a raise in their salaries.
Well, let me point that out too. That you know these benefits and all of this stuff should not be subject to who's in and who's out in the political arena. This is your health insurance,
mm-hmm.
and so what I would say is that the state, for example. Is actually state employees are actually not technically under an insurance arrangement.
No, it's a trust fund.
They're self-funded.
Mm-hmm. Which
so
a lot of major companies do as well.
Most major employers carry their own risk in this way. And so,
well,
you know,
did you read the story of the baby that nearly bankrupted AOL?
No. Oh, yeah, yeah, I think I did.
Because they were self, I think it was AOL, but there was a large company that
right.
pools all their money into a trust fund, and they had one or two babies that had significant health issues
right.
that almost bankrupted their insurance program.
And see, that's another thing. I mean, all of the medical risk of insuring Americans, the smart and efficient way to do that is to put that all into one pool. That pool can absorb all that risk without any
issue.
Well,
and of course, the biggest thing is, you know, of course, the fact that before we get to single payer, we've got to protect, ensure Obamacare.
Exactly right. We have to protect the ACA.
It's not going to be a quick process. Even in a Democratic administration, the Democratic Congress,
I still think implementation
of single payer is going to take a very long time.
It's going to take a long time, but I think that you and I agree. We're both big fans. Of the two of us, only one of us has actually met Hillary Clinton, but it's not me. But I agree with her approach about this, which is, you know, we were in the Obama administration, had gotten to about 90%.
We were on our way to universality.
Well on our way to universal coverage. And the next step to take, at least in my opinion, to get to universal coverage, and universal coverage is the point, is a public option so that mm-hmm. you can cover these gaps where there's not an insurance provider in certain counties and whatever, there should be able to go to a public option. I think that has to be done incrementally, and I just think that's where we're going, and I'm hopeful that train is on the track. So... incredibly, Matt, our hour is up. And so we're going to tell everybody to read Hillary's book,
yes.
even though we acknowledge that, you know.
We hope to get to it, but so far it's a great read.
So far it's a great read, and we're just basking in the enjoyment of a little payback talk and a little behind the scenes real talk.
Some of the things she talks about in the book are things I can sympathize with as having been a former candidate.
Me too.
Of the things that you could say or you couldn't say, or the pressure. And for me, it was being a young candidate who sometimes felt like I was being held to a different standard.
Yeah.
And so I think I can sympathize with Hillary on so many different levels on that.
Yeah.
Because when you had to execute flawlessly, and even
right.
if you executed flawlessly, you could come so close.
Yeah, and when you have an opponent who would not hesitate to say that you weren't flawless even when you were, because facts are not that much of an issue, that makes it tough. But listen, you and I are going to,
we'll have to do this again.
We're going forward together, and you know, we're just going to keep in touch about how things are going with the Democratic Party. I thank you so much for joining us
Absolutely.
Today at the Water Cooler. Everybody have a great weekend.
Follow Gene on Twitter at Gene Bolduc and tweet your comments and questions with the hashtag WCHL.